I'm excited to jump into the book of 1 Samuel with you today. It's been, I'm just going to be honest with you, this has been a week of wrestling with the text. When you read the Old Testament, constantly looking for something called a plot arc. If you like narrative, or you like poetry, or you like literature, looking for a plot arc in the book, or in particularly a particular passage of Scripture, helps you understand what's the point of the passage. So this week I kind of wrestled with what's the plot arc of this first section. But before we get into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the book of 1 Samuel. The book is full of adventures and battles, betrayal, love, secrecy, failures, and victory. It contains perhaps the most famous book of the Bible, or famous story of the Bible. David and Goliath. But what I want us to see is that every page in Samuel is designed to point our attention to Jesus, as we'll see today. The theme of Samuel, or something called the melodic line, the kind of the thread theme throughout the book of Samuel, is this. When God establishes his kingdom, he raises up the humble and lays low the proud. I'd actually like our time today to begin by turning to your table of contents at the book of your at the beginning of the book of your Bible, your table of contents. A lot of times some of us use this when we're first learning to study the Bible to kind of figure out where I'm supposed to go in the Bible. It's like a roadmap. If you look at your table of contents, most of us don't have these sections kind of split up, but the Old Testament is split up into different sections. So I'm going to give you some of those today. I'm going to give you the English sections. They're also split up into Hebrew sections, which I'm not really going to get into right now. So if you look at the first five books of the Bible, they're called the Torah, or Pentateuch, five books. The first five books are the Law of God. Then the next 12 books are called the historical books. The historical books basically give historical accounts of the Bible, particularly following the nation of Israel. Then you have after that, and those go from Joshua all the way to Esther, okay? And then you have something called wisdom and poetic books. This is Job to Song of Solomon or Song of Songs. The five books of wisdom and poetry. Then you have the major prophets, which is Isaiah to Daniel. And then you have the minor prophets, which is Hosea to Malachi, or Malachi. Those are the major categories of the Bible in the Old Testament. So Samuel is one of the historical books. And when you read through the historical books, it's nice to be able to read through the Psalms and the Prophets, because the Psalms and the Prophets serve as kind of commentaries for what's going on in the historical books. For instance, you'll find a lot of the Psalms referencing specific spots happening in the book of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. Or, as you read through the historical books, the accounts of the kings, you'll read through the prophets, and certain prophets are serving during the time of certain kings. And so that's the setting of the book of 1 Samuel. It's a historical book, and it's meant to be read in tandem with Psalms and the prophets at certain times. So the books of 1 and 2 Samuel are intended to be read as a unit. Right? So it was originally one book. A lot of commentators believe that the reason why it's been divided up into two books is because it was too big to fit on one scroll. And so they made two scrolls, which turned into 1 and 2 Samuel. But the books of 1 and 2 Samuel are intended to be one literary unit, and that's how we are going to look at 1 and 2 Samuel. The book focuses on three main characters: Samuel, Saul, and David. It's full of comparisons and contrasts with different characters. For instance, right here in the first couple chapters, we're going to see the comparison of the house of Eli and its contrast with the house of Elkanah and Hannah and Samuel. You'll find Samuel is contrasted with Saul. You'll find that Saul is contrasted with David. And you'll find all kinds of minor contrasts throughout the book. And it, again, those contrasts pull out the melodic line of 1 and 2 Samuel. And that is, when God establishes his kingdom, he raises high the lowly and puts down the proud. The structure of Samuel is based on the author's focus on those three primary characters. Some of you may want to write this down. You don't have to, but chapters 1 through 12 in 1 Samuel focus on Samuel's life and that contrast with Eli and Saul. Then 1 Samuel 13 through 31 focuses on the life of Saul, and that's contrasted with both Samuel and David. And then lastly, 2 Samuel focuses on the life of King David and the various conflicts he has throughout his reign. That's the structure, the basic overlying structure of the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. Now, the prophet Samuel is traditionally seen as the writer of 1 Samuel. Now, if you think about it, there's a problem with this, because he dies in chapter 12. It's hard to write things after you're dead. And so 1 Chronicles 29:29 kind of indicates that Gad, the prophet, and Nathan, the prophet, kind of pick up where Samuel leaves off. Now, Samuel is the last of the judges, because it kind of butts up against the judges, the book of Judges. But he's also the first of the prophets. So he's the final judge and the first of the prophets. And so where does this book fit in the storyline of the Bible? I'll bring that up to speed. How do we get to 1 Samuel? Well, the book of Samuel records how Israel becomes a kingdom. To understand the significance of a kingdom, I'm just going to give kind of an overview of what kingdoms and kings are in the Old Testament. To understand the significance of a kingdom, we need to understand God's original design for creation. All right? So when God created Adam and Eve, he created them to have dominion over all his creation. If you turn to Genesis 1, and you look at Genesis 1, verses 26 through the end of the chapter, you find that Adam and Eve were originally created to be kings and queens over his creation. He created them to be the first king and queen over his creation, but under his authority. In Genesis 3, when Adam and Eve sinned, they chose to throw off God's authority by disobeying his command. And by eating the fruit, they were seeking to dethrone the sovereign king of the universe. It was a fundamental misunderstanding of their created role to rule under the sovereign authority of the King of Heaven. So now Adam and Eve finish their lives sitting on broken thrones with twisted crowns and shattered scepters. Then you fast forward to the Exodus after 400 years. Excuse me. In Genesis 3:15, I don't want to miss this. In Genesis 3:15, God makes a promise to this couple that one day an offspring of the queen would crush the authority or rule of the snake who brought sin and death. So this offspring would restore the relationship between mankind and God and rule submissively as a true and better Adam. As we keep reading through the Bible, we see God making promises to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, and the people of Israel that a king will come to rule his people. After they are put into exile in Egypt for 400 years, God rescues his people and brings them into the land he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The book of Joshua is an account of the conquest of God's people taking possession of the promised land as tribes, not yet a kingdom. When we read through the book of Judges, we find that God rules over his people through special leaders he calls judges. He does not call them kings. Men like Gideon and Jephthah and Samson. The book of Judges records utter chaos. In fact, the final two accounts, it's not the final two chapters, but the final two episodes of Judges record murder, rape, and the near decimation of an entire tribe of Benjamin. It's just utter chaos. The final verse of Judges reads this: "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes." The book of Samuel follows the book of Judges historically. In fact, some commentators believe that Samson was born about 10 years ahead of Samuel. So they're butting right up against each other. So when we get to 1 Samuel, Israel is a fractured nation composed of 12 tribes with very little cohesion or unity. Israel is a bit like the land of Scotland in the movie Braveheart. The lords were squabbling with one another, jostling for power, without any king to unify them until Robert the Bruce puts them all together. Now, of course, that's like not a real historical account, but that's kind of the idea of what's going on in as we get to Samuel. So that brings us to the book of 1 Samuel. Our passage today is split up into three sections, and those sections are focused on Hannah. All right? First, Hannah's problem in verses 1 through 8. Second, Hannah's petition in verses 9 through 18. And third, Hannah's praise in verses 119 through 211. Now, if you've noticed something, I didn't give you the main idea, and I didn't give you the exhortation yet. It's because I want the passage to kind of reveal that as we go. I'll give it to you in a little bit. Because the passage is so long, I'm just going to read it as we go through. Okay, so let's read 1 Samuel 1, 1 through 2. "Now there was a certain man of Ramoth Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jerohim, the son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children." Immediately we're introduced to a man named Elkanah. He has two wives. Hannah, whose name means grace, and Peninnah, whose name means jewel or pearl. So Elkanah's lineage is shared because Elkanah was likely from a notable family that lived in the region of Ramah in the hill country of the tribe of Ephraim. So while we're introduced to Elkanah, we found out quickly that he's not really the main human character in our passage. Grace is Hannah. So, I just skipped a page in my notes. Let me back up. In verse 2, we're introduced to Hannah and Peninnah with a statement that would have been very cringy with the original readers. And it serves to introduce the conflict of our story. Look at the last sentence of verse 2. "And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children." As we keep reading, we'll find that this conflict, the conflict between proud Peninnah and humble Hannah, will grow worse and worse as Peninnah takes every opportunity to rub Hannah's face in her barrenness. Why is Hannah's barrenness such a big deal, as we'll find in this passage? Why is she so distraught throughout this passage? Well, for many in today's culture, having no children is almost seen as a good thing. A mom without kids, for many in our culture, is seen by many as a woman free from the shackles of responsibility to raise children so that she can focus on her career. That's how many people in our world view a mother without children, a wife without children. So many today may read this and wonder why Hannah is so busted up about not having children. But it's because in the historical context of the day, children were a means of status and wealth, actually. Having lots of children not only meant that you had more hands to farm with, and shepherd, or even battle if your family's attacked. It also meant that you likely had the means to feed your family and to keep them healthy with medicine. So a lady who had lots of children was contributing to the wealth and status of her family through her very nature as a woman. But if a woman was not able to produce children, her barrenness laid on her a deep sense of shame. It wasn't just based on something she had done or hadn't done. It was based on her nature as a woman, not able to produce. It went right, her shame went right down to the core of her being. So Hannah bears a shame that she cannot remove on her own. Her shame can only be removed by the birth of a child. God must remove her shame by opening her womb, as we shall see in this passage. So not only does Hannah bear that shame, she has someone consistently reminding her of that shame. In verse 7, if you peek at verse 7, it tells us that every time Hannah went up to the place of worship, She suffered the trauma of Peninnah's humiliating attacks. It's as if Peninnah is saying, "You don't have children because I worship God correctly and you do not." So the shame of Hannah's barrenness is the conflict exacerbated by Peninnah's constant berating. There's nothing in and of herself that Hannah can do to remove the shame of her barrenness. But despite Hannah's barrenness and the constant attacks of Peninnah, she's married to a godly man who loves her unconditionally. Look at verses 3 through 5. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion, because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. In Deuteronomy 16, God commands that all the men of Israel should come up to the place of worship three times a year to observe three feasts or festivals. So Elkanah is faithfully worshiping and sacrificing to Yahweh in his yearly pilgrimage. At the feast, Elkanah distributes equal portions of the meal, of the food to his family. But he does something different with Hannah. He gives her a double portion. Why? Well, the text tells us. Because he loved her. No matter what. She didn't have children. I still love you, no matter what. Elkanah clearly is trying to comfort Hannah while Peninnah seeks to humiliate her at every opportunity. Peninnah is the original mean girl. Constantly looking to be a hater. But notice the important little phrase that comes at the end of verse 5. Look at the end of verse 5. He loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. We find that same verse, same phrase in the next verse. Look at the end of verse 6. Because the Lord had closed her womb. Verse 6. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. All throughout the redemptive story of the Bible, we find that God is sovereign over everything, but especially he is sovereign over the gift of children. Hannah's story highlights this very fact powerfully. God is sovereign over the birth of children. And we see this highlighted just one page back in the story of Ruth and Boaz. From nothing, God gives Ruth and Mara, Naomi, a child. God's gift of children are never guaranteed, nor are they given to someone as a result of their good works. In the Bible, barrenness is always the means by which God develops faith in the life of the barren lady. Always. So how do you respond in times of extreme grief, shame, affliction, and pain? Some of us are prone to grit our teeth, ball up our fists, and raise them up at God for withholding something that we rightly deserve. Because God, you haven't given me children, or because you haven't given me a job, or because you haven't given me a house or a spouse. Oh, I'm mad at God. Friends, the gospel speaks directly to this. Are you angry at God for not giving you something? Brothers and sisters, from the day we're conceived, we are entitled to nothing but God's wrath. Nothing but God's wrath, because we are sinners. We are born sinners. Our nature is that we are sinners, enemies of God. So when God gives us anything but wrath, anything but the hell we deserve, we are receiving an overwhelming abundance of his grace. Every breath is a new marker of his mercy and grace. Every sip of water is a new marker of his grace. Every taste of food, every hug is a new marker of his grace. So even more than that, the gospel reminds us that though we are sinners, God has lavishly blessed us, not just with tangible things from his common grace, but he has given us himself. He gave himself. He could not have given us more. He could not have given us a more precious and valuable gift than himself. So the next time your heart is tempted to be angry with God for withholding something from you, preach the gospel to your heart. In Christ, God has overwhelmingly given us far more than we deserve. Friends, God was sovereign over Hannah's closed womb and the shame of her barrenness. But God didn't leave her there. What's Hannah's response to the affliction of her enemy and the shame of barrenness? Well, look at verse 7. The end. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. Sometimes, barrenness, sorrow, pain, and shame crush us under their weight. So Elkanah gently tries to console the weeping wife, his weeping wife. Look at verse 8. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart sad?" You can almost picture him gently embracing her, raising her chin to look into his eyes and asking, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart so sad?" And Elkanah finishes his tender questions in a typical clunky man fashion. "Aren't I more important to you than a full family?" I mean, you'd expect him to say something like, "Hey, Hannah, you are more important to me than 10 sons." What's he say? "Aren't I more valuable to you than 10 sons?" Comically, his words are focused more on his value than hers. So just like a prudent wife, she actually doesn't respond to him. "That was such a stupid thing to say, but I know you're trying to be kind." Elkanah's questions, though, touch at the core of the conflict in this chapter. Then they're intended to be questions that we are supposed to ask as readers. Why is she weeping? Why is she not eating? Why is her heart not happy? Why is it sad? It's because Hannah is bearing the shame of barrenness, a shame she cannot remove on her own. And her rival is capitalizing on every opportunity to rub her nose in her shame. So how does Hannah answer Elkanah's questions? She doesn't. She's silent. She actually doesn't speak until verse 11, when she carries her burdens to someone greater than her husband, the God of the universe. But look at verse 9 before we get there. After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple and the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. Hannah rises up after the meal where she didn't eat, and she goes to the temple. Now a careful reader will understand that there's a problem here. First, the temple is not in Shiloh, and second, the temple won't be built for 100 years. So why is this word temple here? It's a word which means dwelling place or palace. And it's often used in reference to the temple as the place where God's presence most thickly dwells, on the mercy seat, which is his earthly throne here on this planet. So Hannah rises up and goes directly to the King of Kings. Though Israel does not yet have a king, she goes right to the King of Kings with her problem. Look at verse 10. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. Hannah is in utter distress and anguish of heart, and she carries her burdens to the Lord. This is the proper response to grief, sorrow, and anguish of soul. A sick heart. She didn't go to her husband to relieve the pain in her heart. He does not have that ability. He's not sufficient to do that. She went directly to the sovereign King of heaven. Verse 11, then, is the first time we hear Hannah speak. And it is the heart of this slice of the narrative. Whenever you're reading narrative and someone speaks for the first time, you should listen, because it often carries a lot of significance. Listen to her prayer in verse 11. Verse 11, and she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. What do you notice about her prayer? Look at her first words. What are her first words? O Lord of hosts. This is the words in Hebrew, Yahweh Sabaoth. They're God's fighting name. It means Lord of armies. Yahweh over the armies, the hosts. Hannah is crying out for God to do battle and rescue her, a damsel in distress. She refers to herself three times as your servant, Yahweh's servant. She understands what the priests don't understand in chapter 2. She understands what Saul doesn't understand once he's anointed the first king of Israel. She understands what Eve forgot in the garden. God is the sovereign king over all things, and she is his servant. He is king even over barrenness. So she petitions God for help. But what is specifically she asking for? Look at the verse. Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant, remember me and not forget your servant, and will give to your servant a son. She does this in the form of a vow. Then I will give him back to you, and he will serve with no razor touching his head, which is a reference to the Nazarite vow. In other words, complete and total dedication to Yahweh his whole life. So what is it she specifically asking for, though? She asks God to look on her affliction. Not to look past her. Not to miss her in the crowd. See me, God. Look at my affliction. Remember me. Don't forget me, God. And then she says, Lord, give me a son. And if God gives her a son, she'll give him back to God to serve him all the days of his life. But I want you to notice something. How many children does she ask for here? One. She's not asking for a whole gaggle of children. She's not asking for wealth or status or a public display of her own fruitfulness, her fruitful nature as a woman. No, she's simply asking for one, a son who will remove the shame and affliction tied to her very nature. Only God can remove her shame through the provision of a son. A son who will turn her shame, anxiety, vexation, and pain into tears of joy, gladness, and shalom, peace. A son who will turn her silent prayers of sorrow in verse 11 into exclamations of praise in chapter 2. Because the Lord of hosts has rescued her from her affliction and removed her shame. This is the main idea in the passage. Only our sovereign God can remove our shame and affliction through the Son. Only God can remove our shame and affliction through the provision of a Son. Hannah's prayer echoes the promise of Genesis 3:15. Through the seed of a woman would come a conquering king who would crush Satan, defeating him and death, and reconciling sinful humanity back to God. The prayer of Hannah, whose name means grace, points us directly to Jesus, the eternal Son of God, whom God gave to remove our shame and guilt and affliction. This Son would come through God's grace. Now, through Satan, though Satan hurls his accusations like Peninnah. Though he daily accuses us and reminds us of the shame we bear in our very nature as sinners, God has given us a son, an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Though Satan may remind us and accuse us daily, moment by moment by moment, hurling his accusations at us, God's Son has removed our shame and guilt through his eternal atoning sacrifice on the cross. In fact, there's a reason why Hannah's prayer in 1 Samuel 2, verses 1 through 10 is almost identical to Mary's Magnificat in Luke 1. Luke wants us to see that Hannah's prayer for Samuel was the arrow that pointed directly to Jesus, the greater Son who removes the sin of the world, the shame connected to our very nature. It's through God's gift of his only begotten Son that our sin and our shame and our affliction and our guilt are removed. Hannah could not remove it herself. God must provide a son. When we trust in the Son to rescue us, he does indeed. He takes our shame and our sin and our guilt on himself, and we get his righteousness and royalty forever. Man of sorrows, he bore our sin and our shame. Let's keep going. In verse 12, Eli the priest, the one who's supposed to be God's representative to God's people, can't even recognize true piety when it's staring him in the face. That dullness will come up again later. Look at verses 13 through 14. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, "How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you." Hannah answered, "Oh, my Lord, I'm a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I've been pouring out my heart before the Lord. Don't regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I've been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation." If you notice, Hannah never shares her requests with Eli. Hannah responds to Eli's accusations of drunkenness by saying that rather than pouring wine down her throat, she has been pouring her soul out to God, giving him her great anxiety and vexation. What a powerful illustration of how to respond to affliction, barrenness, and anxiety. She has turned her bitterness, the bitterness of her soul, into liquid and poured it out like an offering to the Lord. And look how Eli responds, now seeing Hannah's true heart. And look how Eli, who now sees Hannah's true heart, responds in verse 17. Eli answered her, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him." Remember, again, Hannah has never shared her request with Eli. Yet he says, "Go in shalom." It's not just the word peace. It's in Hebrew, it's the idea of completeness or wholeness. Be the idea of something that is unfractured, free of chaos, complete wholeness. He's saying, go in wholeness, the wholeness that only God provides. And may God of Israel give you what you've asked for. His answer, again, points to what Jesus does in the life of those who trust in him. He provides completeness, shalom, peace. The word, again, for wholeness and completion in the life of those who trust in him. Colossians is an entire book about that. Our completion in Christ. We're made complete in him. Hannah responds with a request for favor or grace. It's a play on her own name, a play on words. a request for favor, grace, as her name means, grace. And what happens? Don't miss the end of verse 18. She no longer has a sad face. She's eating again. This is an act of trust in God. Even though God had not yet fulfilled her request, she trusts in God in her heart, and her trust literally changes her face and her diet. The anxiety, the shame, the guilt, gone. Even before the child is born. I keep reading in verse 19. Then they arose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to the house, to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due season, in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel, for she said, I have asked for him from the Lord. What's the response? What's the result of Hannah's prayer? More worship. Worship. Don't miss the fact that intimacy here in Hannah and Elkanah's marriage was an act of faith. After years of barrenness, you can imagine the baggage that came with their intimacy in marriage. Lots of baggage. And with another wife. Imagine the baggage that came with their marriage. Hesitancy, hopelessness, years of crushed hopes and trauma tied directly to barrenness. Now, Hannah trusts God with those years of crushed hopes embedded in their intimacy. Only the Son can remove the shame found in their intimacy in marriage, as He can with your marriage as well. And the Lord remembered her. She conceives and bears a son and calls his name Samuel, which means his name is God. I want to point out that God is not obliged or obligated to say yes to Hannah's request. He does not have to. Sometimes God says no. Sometimes God says, wait, year after year after year. As he did, he says no to the Apostle Paul. And he does that so that he may show his grace, his strength in our weakness. When God says no to that job or that spouse or to that child, he is sufficient to care for all our needs. The question is, in your own heart, do you believe that God is enough, even when he says no? I want you to notice that in verses 19 through 28, I'm not going to read the whole section here, but in verses 19 through 28, the son produces nothing but worship in the life of Hannah, Elkanah, and Eli. Hannah waits until the child is weaned before she takes him to God's place to serve with Eli. In ancient times, children weren't typically weaned for 3 to 5 years, actually. So Samuel was likely between the ages of 3 to 5. So when they offer a 3-year-old bull to the Lord in verses 24 through 25 when they arrive, the point is to say that they are offering a living sacrifice to the Lord for all he has done. Samuel is to be a living sacrifice to the Lord. Hannah is faithfully keeping her vow to the Lord in offering her child as a living sacrifice to the Lord. Now, Hannah gives us yet another powerful example of how to view our children as parents. As parents, we're not to turn our children into idols, clinging to them, hovering over them at every turn to be sure they're safe. Rather, we must hold our children with open palms before the Lord, yielding them to Him. What an example Hannah is to us. Now, we could spend weeks studying Hannah's prayer here in verses 1 through 10. But for the sake of time, I'm not going to. I want to pull out a couple notable points. One point I want to point out is that Hannah's prayer serves as a sort of thesis statement for the rest of the book of Samuel. And the prayer is structured in a chiasm, so which tells you right at the middle is going to be kind of the main idea of this section. And the prayer, at the heart of her prayer, is her declaration that true strength comes from the Lord. It is the Lord who has true strength. And you'll notice that the theme of her prayer is that God raises up the humble and lays low the proud. Something we just observed in Hannah's life, with Peninnah being laid low and Hannah being raised up through trusting God. In fact, there are many commentators, some commentators believe that verse 4 is the theme verse for all of Samuel. Look at verse 4. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. We'll find that contrast, the contrast of the proud and the humble, all through the book of Samuel, as God raises up the humble and lays low the proud. So as we wrap up our time together, I just want to give two brief take-home truths. One, never underestimate the power of a praying lady. Never underestimate the power of a praying lady. Hannah's prayer impacts a whole nation. Throughout history, the prayer of women have shaped the course of time. I think of specifically, my mind is drawn to Monica. Cities in California, Santa Monica, is named after Augustine's mom, St. Augustine. And St. Augustine actually, there's some heresy that he kind of wrestles with, but actually a lot of what he said has served as the foundation for a lot of the theology of our church today. And we are obviously distinct in some major areas, but God used Augustine to combat some very bad heresies in his time. And he was not a Christian for a very long time, but his mom was faithfully praying for him. She faithfully prayed through tears, weeping over and over and over. And God used those prayers to save her son. It's the same type of situation. Mom, if you have a child that, I know some in our church have children that are grown and are wayward, don't stop praying. Mom, you have children running around the house. One of your most important roles as a mother is to pray for the children God has given you. Never underestimate the power of a praying lady. Second, the Lord is sovereign over all things, even our affliction. Church, suffering is a part of the Christian life. God allows trials and actually enables trials in our lives to purify faith. In the trial, don't get angry. Don't get bitter. But also, don't allow yourself to be crushed. Do exactly what Hannah does. Go to the Lord in prayer. He meets you in your sorrow, in your barrenness, in your brokenness. Let your heart be trained to trust in the Son who removes our shame and our affliction. Let's pray.